Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to the Regional Reporters Call. At this time, all lines are in a listen-only mode, and you may queue up for your questions by pressing star then one on your touch-tone phone. Just a reminder, we will be limiting you to one question per media. And again, it's star one for your questions. I'd also like to remind you that today's conference is being recorded. And I'll turn the conference over to Elizabeth Alexander for opening remarks.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for getting on the call today. The Vice President will first give an opening statement, and then we'll go to questions. Stand by for the Vice President.
Hey, folks. Joe Biden. Glad to have you all on. I want to make a brief opening statement, and I'll try to respond to any questions you have. I apologize. My allergies are bothering me, so excuse the occasional cough. Again, thanks for joining in. Look, let me start by saying I think it's fair that to say that no administration in a long, long time has moved so swiftly to deal with so many monumental challenges our nation has faced that we inherited. I've been here for eight presidents, and at least in the past, there's been significant issues that a president's been able to say when they've begun, look, I'm going to put this on the side for a minute, I'm going to deal with these other things, and then come back to it, because I knew the status quo would not have changed. But, you know, in these first 100 days, every single issue the president faced, from foreign policy, national security, domestic policy, economic policy, a non-decision would have been a decision. There's not a single solitary one of these issues where we could have put them aside and the status quo would have pertained 2, 3, 5, 6, 8 months from now. So that's what I mean when I say these challenges have been real, immediate, and I think that the administration, you'd expect me to say this, has been awfully busy in ways that other presidents haven't in the first 100 days, and as the president says, even our critics would agree we've been pretty busy the last 100 days. And here's a quick recap. We were able to, after some considerable time debating this over the previous couple years, pass the Ledbetter Free Pay Act to deal with wage discrimination in the workplace. We've increased the children covered by CHIP to 11 million kids. The president signed an executive order setting significantly higher ethical standards in government, putting an end to the use of torture as a de facto matter, and agreeing to shut down, announcing to shut down Guantanamo within a year in an orderly fashion. He's also laid out a plan to redeploy our troops from Iraq, and of course, there's been a series of very decisive steps to deal with our economy. We've moved to stabilize our financial system and to begin the process of getting credit flowing again, and we moved to breathe some life back into the housing market, which is beginning to slowly revive. We have an excess capacity out there, but millions of people are refinancing their homes, saving themselves over a yearly period thousands of dollars. We're working like the devil to get our industry back on track by right from the beginning agreeing to help it restructure itself so it can be more competitive in the next decade and beyond. And the president, I thought, did a very good job, you'd expect me to say that as well, in coordinating the global response to this economic crisis. And maybe most consequentially, at least in my experience, within weeks, less than a month of being sworn in, we were able to pass into law the biggest Recovery and Reinvestment Act in American history to keep the bottom from totally falling out of the economy. Most economists acknowledge had we not done it, there would have been, on top of the rising unemployment, which will continue for some time, there would have been another 3 to 5 million unemployed people beyond what we would we're going to see. And that plan cut taxes for 95% of Americans collecting a paycheck. It extended unemployment benefits, which is not only necessary for life supports for people, but we increased the amount of the of that unemployment check. Healthcare coverage through COBRA for people who've lost their jobs so they can continue to have healthcare. And we've undertaken the biggest investment on our nation's interstate highway system since Dwight Eisenhower, invested billions of dollars, begun the process of investing billions of dollars in a new superhighway energy grid to be able to transmit renewable energy. And we've doubled our investment in rebuilding our schools. We've also had significant countercyclical help. I was on the telephone today, as I am every week, with governors. I think it was six governors today and 8 or 10 mayors and county executives, which I do once a week after cabinet meetings I call on the Recovery Act. And without exception, including the Republican governors we've spoken to, there is a real sigh of relief. Today I was told that by the governor of Wisconsin, I was told by the governor of New York, I was told by the governor of Iowa, they happen to be Democrats in this case, that without the Recovery Act, they would have been really just up a creek. They would be in real deep trouble. It is the countercyclical impact for teachers and cops and firemen has made a real difference in the quality of people's lives as well as protecting them. And we're also taking the first, as I said, mentioned very briefly, first serious critical steps towards energy efficiency, investing in wind, solar, and energy technologies of the future. But the single biggest bang for the buck, every environmentalist and every energy expert will tell you, is conservation and weatherization. We're making a major effort along those lines. And we believe that we'll be able to show, when this act is finished and spent out over the next 18 months, that we will have created or saved 3.5 million jobs. Now, look, we don't have any illusions about how tough this challenge is going to continue to be. We are beginning to see some glimmers of hope, but the fact of the matter is it's going to be a tough year. We're going to still see more job losses, more foreclosures, more difficulties in the credit markets, but most importantly, we are beginning the process of helping us build a ladder to climb out of this hole. And in the process, I would argue, we are building a stable platform for the economic recovery and growth in the 21st century, which leads me to my last point. And that is that we have been criticized, the president and I, about being too ambitious. We've been told that why don't we just stick to reviving the economy? Well, the truth of the matter is that we have really no choice. I don't know a single person who is credible in either party out there who would say that we can build and put ourselves in a dominant position in the 21st century without a fundamental change in our energy policy, a fundamental change in our healthcare policy, and a fundamental change in our education policy. So we are not dealing with health care just because it's a moral imperative, because it's an absolute economic fiscal necessity to get our budget back in control over time. We are not dealing with energy just because we want people to be able to pay lower bills when they do, but it relates to the independence of the United States from those very people that are funding the people who are causing us great difficulty internationally. And it also will drive down, the cost of energy has to be driven down in order for us to get control of our economy and our budget. And lastly, as my wife would say, you know, any country that out-educates us, they're going to out-compete us. We need to revolutionize education here in America, and we're serious about it. And that includes not only spending of dollars, but reforming the education system in the process. So we don't think we have bitten off more than we chew. We think we can chew. We believe we've bitten off exactly what we need to. It is a big gulp, I acknowledge, but in order to get us back on track so, again, we can be the dominant economic force in the 21st century. That's the essence of how you might guess I would view it, but I'm happy to try to respond to any questions you have. And I'm going to put you on speaker because I guess I'm going to have a referee here helping me out do this. So give me just a second. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Thank you.
Okay. Fire away.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, again, if you have a question, please press star 1. And also a reminder, you will be limited to one question. We'll go first to Thomas Burr with the Salt Lake Tribune.
Mr. Vice President, thank you for your time. When the President signed the stimulus package, he said the federal government would post a website that details where every dollar was spent. So far, recovery.gov doesn't seem to show more than the basic program amounts flowing to the states. Is the White House backtracking on transparency there?
No, not at all. As you know, if you went on some of our individual websites, the Department of Agriculture, Department of Housing, there's much more detail that's laid out by congressional district and the rest. But here's what we're doing. We are in the process of consolidating every single one of the websites each of the cabinet positions have, each of the departments. We are putting out to bid the process of developing this website. We hope that by the summer you'll be able to go on and not only see how much money is being spent and where and what projects, but in one spot be able to zero in on a county or on a state and be able to determine exactly how much money in totality from every aspect of the $387 billion is being spent in that state on what project, for what purpose, whether it's on time, not on time. This is turning out to be a monumental technical requirement. And so we have a fellow named Ed DeSev, who is the CEO of this operation, working with the Board of Comptroller Generals that are putting together this website. The board actually controls the money for the website. But we hope, and it is our fervent desire and our commitment that we will have the most comprehensive website that I think you've ever seen in government up and running, so you can look with precision at exactly what's being spent where. But we've only been at this now for about 70 days. So I hope if there's any particular project you might be aware of in Utah or in Salt Lake you want detail on, when we get off this call, call us. We'll give it to you. We'll tell you exactly what we know.
Thank you. We'll go next to David Shepherdson with the Detroit News.
Thanks, Mr. Vice President. One issue that you guys have spent a lot of time are the problems of GM and Chrysler. Certainly, you're no stranger to the two auto companies with their presence in Delaware. Do you think that Chrysler will have to file for bankruptcy in order to restructure successfully, and do you think in bankruptcy it can successfully complete this tie-up with Fiat?
Well, the answer to both questions is I don't know. But here's what I do think. I am an optimist, as my neurosurgeon once said, a congenital optimist. I believe that Chrysler, based on the commitments and the further sacrifices that the auto workers have made and concessions they've made, coupled with a number of Chrysler's debt holders have agreed to a deal where they would be willing to take a considerably less cash for their stake in the company. There are still some holdouts. Whether it all gets done in time and still locks up the completes the Fiat deal, which appears pretty close at hand, is going to be a close call. So I'm not prepared to predict what that outcome will be. But I do believe it's within Chrysler's capacity that either through this reorganization on their own and tying up with Fiat and or an orderly reorganization and bankruptcy to survive and come out of this thing. And with regard to General Motors, General Motors has until early summer to come up with their June 1st, I think it is, to come up with their with their plan. And again, I am optimistic because if you look at what General Motors is talking about now, and I know covering Detroit, you know as much or more about it than I do, but they're making the really very hard decisions that, quite frankly, they have to make to be viable. in terms of number of dealerships, in terms of the brands they're going to continue to carry. These are wrenching, painful decisions that are going through. But again, I come away from this process, maybe because I come from an automobile family. My dad, there was a bad joke in my family. The son or daughter of an automobile dealer, and my dad was a manager, is the first kid in the neighborhood to know what the word recession means, and the last one in the neighborhood to know what recovery means. And I know Detroit is going through this painful transition now. But I'm of the view that the reorganizational structure that is underway in both these major companies is A, doable, and B, because of the workforce we have and a restructured automobile industry, I really genuinely believe that American automobiles can still, in the next decade of the 21st century, lead the world. I really believe that. But this required some major reorganization. They were very slow, management, to recognize it and act. They're acting now. I think it can be done within the time frame set, but I'm not prepared to bet my daughter's graduate school tuition on that.
Thank you. Next, we have Sam Hananel with the Associated Press.
Yes, Mr. Vice President, how is the White House involved in the ongoing discussions to work out a compromise on the Employee Free Choice Act, the card check bill, and what does Arlen Specter's party switch mean for the prospects of getting that bill through the Senate this year?
Well, I can't intelligently comment on the second part. Arlen is a close friend but a very independent guy, and I take Arlen at his word. He has stated publicly he thinks something needs to be done but does not like the card check provision relating to secret ballot being eliminated. But knowing Arlen, I believe Arlen will probably have an open mind if there's a compromise offered, but I don't know that. That's my 34-year history of dealing with him. He's a intelligent, open-minded guy, and I think he would listen to alternatives. But again, I don't know. With regard to the first part, we are working very closely with labor. We support card check. We have said so during the campaign. We continue to say so. We've been listening to the organized labor as well as business in their mutual concerns about this. We believe that the present system is tilted against what was initially intended by the NLRB, if you go back and look at the legislation from back in those days, it says that one of the purposes, not to guarantee unions, to promote the ability of people to be able to organize. We think that has been, as my grandfather used to say, that's been stood on its head. It has been made such a thick, a tricky wicket for labor to have to go through, it's rendered it more of an endurance contest than what was intended. So I still remain hopeful that we'll be able to get card check passed. We're supportive of it. We will continue to support it. But we are in constant discussions with both business and labor about rectifying what we believe to be a significant inequity that exists now.
Okay, thank you. We'll go next to Boris Krasiniak with the Scranton Times.
Mr. Vice President, thank you. Can you comment a little bit further on Senator Specter's conversion, your role in it, and to what extent do you think he'll be helpful to the president's agenda?
Only if you'll send me a gallon of spaghetti sauce from Prino's.
From Prino's.
All right?
I'll talk to her.
And we can work something out. I guess that's illegal. But covering Scranton and Pennsylvania, you know Arlen as well as I do. I start off with a bias. He's been my friend and confidant for well over 30 years. We've worked together on a wide range of really critical issues, from Supreme Court nominations, the Bork nomination, and we've disagreed in the Thomas nomination. I mean, we have been together for a long, long time. One thing I walk away with knowing about Arlen, one, he has more courage than most people I know, Number two, he is absolutely independent, and he decides on a course, and he takes it. And he usually is able to sustain an incredibly rigorous intellectual rationale for the position he takes. Having said that, I believe Arlen became convinced that the Republican Party left him. You know, I was talking with him today before we went out, and we were reminiscing. When I first got here, there was Hugh Scott of Pennsylvania. There was a moderate Republican leader following him named Griffith from Michigan. There was Hatfield from Oregon. There was Packwood from Oregon. There were Javits of New York, Case of New Jersey. I mean, the intellectual gravamen of the Republican Party was a centrist party, conservative in a traditional sense. And they're all gone except for two now. There's, as I read it, the two senators from Maine. And I think what Arlen, it was a very tough decision for Arlen, I can tell you from my many conversations with him. But I think he concluded and meant what he said, that he wasn't prepared to let his 29 years of service in the Senate be judged by what he believes to be a relatively narrow slice of the state of Pennsylvania in an increasingly marginalized Republican Party in the state, taken over by very conservative elements. So, and when I talked to him this morning, the only thing I was saying, he said it publicly, so I'm not talking out of school. He said it, that he said, I just want you to know, Joe, I'm comfortable. I'm completely comfortable with this decision. It was a hard one to make, but I'm comfortable. I think he knows he's going to be with a lot more people who are much more like-minded on the major issues with him than he was in a very shrinking Republican caucus as it relates to centrist and moderates.
We'll go next to Dan Nowicki with the Arizona Republic.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Vice President. I was just wondering if you could walk us through the policy agenda for the next 100 days, and I was wondering specifically if immigration reform is going to be on that and where that might fall.
Well, then immigration reform is on the agenda. The top of the agenda, the very top, is health care, because both from a fiscal standpoint and a moral standpoint, we believe that to be, if you're going to rank them, and it's hard to rank these things, that would be number one. But again, it goes, in terms of our budget, education, healthcare, and energy. But at the same time, immigration is, people say, well, you know, you're not going to get immigration done in this economic environment this year. And my response is the president's. You can't finish if you don't start. And we've got to start serious discussions, serious negotiations on immigration now. I hope we'd be able to complete it this year, but whether we can or not, we have to start. The sooner we start, the higher the prospect is we will have a comprehensive immigration reform. And at the same time this is going on, we're going to be unable to take our eye off of Iraq as well as Pakistan and Afghanistan. So I would say the agenda is going to be consumed at the front end by implementation and passing the budget on health care, and there's some very difficult decisions to be made there. Also on energy, very difficult but critical decisions to be made there, and on education. They are the guts of how we believe we regain control of our fiscal house and regain control of the direction of the country.
Thank you. We'll go to Tom Lotshaw with the Marietta Register.
Hi, Vice President Biden. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you clearly. Can you hear me?
I can. Yes.
Okay.
Hey, last October when you were in November campaigning, I know you got some hearty rounds of applause saying that you were going to go back and work on another SOLAS exemption for the Delta Queen. And I understand that it kind of fell apart, and with the boat, I guess there's a hearing coming up about permanently mooring it down in Chattanooga. I was wondering if that's something the administration plans on following through with.
Well, that's above my pay grade. What we're not going to do is we're not going to interfere with these local decisions on that. My generic point is that we believe that the more that counties, cities, states can stimulate the local economy, produce jobs, generate income, it's better for everyone. And I have to admit to you, I'm a little bit mildly sentimental about the Delta Queen, and I'm an Easterner, so. But I remember way, way back being. But it really is beyond our ability or our brief to make that kind of judgment. But let me raise another question, though. You don't think of Delta Queen in terms of transportation. I know that, but there's a transportation piece of what we're trying to do, not with the Delta Queen, but with all the localities and as well as with the states. And that is, we made a significant investment in infrastructure for light rail and rail, and we've made a significant investment in intra-city rail and high-speed rail. And so these are all things that we believe go to both our promoting jobs and growth as well as dealing with our environmental problems and reduction of consumption of oil. But I realize that's way beyond the brief of the Delta Queen.
We have time for one last question.
Thank you. That will come from Aaron Harbor with the Denver Daily News.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vice President, and all of us appreciate the amount of time you're spending with us. I want to ask you about, all the analyses on the healthcare side seem to prove that the only way to provide healthcare to all Americans without drastically increasing the cost is to go to a single-payer system, which I think everyone understands essentially shifts all those resources that are spent on health insurance companies directly to providing medical care to the people who need it. Has the president abandoned this approach? And if so, how will the administration find the resources to fund any kind of significant health care initiative that's really universal without either increasing the federal deficit or raising taxes or a single payer still on the table?
Well, if you notice, the president and I during our campaign did not embrace the single payer system as our formula for how to deal with reducing health care costs at the same time increasing access. That's number one. Number two, we put in our budget a total of 634, I believe it is, billion dollars as a down payment over 10 years to deal with reducing health care costs as well as providing and making it available affordably to all Americans. Here's where we are. There's going to be and we laid out exactly how we pay for that. We paid for that by eliminating, among other things, the payment to insurance companies for Medicare. We also paid for it by not renewing the tax cut for the top 1% of the taxpayers. We also paid for it by other changes in the tax code, by changing the way in which the amount able to be deducted for charitable deductions so that the very wealthy were treated exactly like the middle class and so on. And we laid that out. Now, people say that the Congress rejected that. Well, they haven't rejected anything yet officially, and what they're doing now, and it's literally a topic of conversation, the meeting I'm having tomorrow with the president and our team. I'm not having the meeting. I'm attending the meeting because we're getting constant inquiries from our friends on the Hill. For example, in the Senate, a Republican conservative senator named Grassley from Iowa, ranking member of Finance, is working very closely with a centrist senator named Baucus, the chairman from Montana, and we have for the first time a confluence of interest here where business understands there's a need for a health care system and remarkable change in cost, as well as do the unions and you know, both liberals and conservatives are focusing on this because they've realized it's a fiscal issue as well. Here you had over the last, I think it was 8 years, health care premiums gone up 58%. Income has risen 3%. If you look at the budget and you look at the line on a graph as the increased cost in Medicare and Medicaid, it exponentially increases, is unsustainable. So there's a consensus now that we have to deal with it for fiscal responsibility, in terms of just fiscal responsibility, which leads to the following point. I'm not trying to avoid your question. What I am trying to say is there is no way that you're going to be able to have a program that's going to cost somewhere in excess of a trillion dollars over that 10-year period without there being some cuts and or some additional revenue. And they're all up in there, and they're all in play. We've laid out what we do, and now you have the House and Senate beginning to come back with everything from, you know, floating ideas of a sin tax, taxing, you know, as it relates to, this is not us, but it's coming from the Hill. There's talk about dealing with high-income surcharge. They're talking about, we think as they go through all this, they're going to start coming back the way that we think this should be paid for. But the bottom line is we're just beginning that process now, and we're going to be required in order to meet the goals of the healthcare system we want, not only to build in significant savings, significant investment by computerization of healthcare records, by modernization of healthcare forms, by insisting that there be prevention be a major component here. For example, we spend, if my memory serves me correctly, and this is off the top of my head, I think it's 72 cents of every dollar we spend in healthcare is spent on chronic disease. We don't manage chronic disease very well at all. So there's a lot of savings here if we're willing to tackle prevention and modernization, as well as we're going to have to find revenue or cut programs in order to pay for this. It's that simple. But absent doing that, I know of no way we gain control of our budget and keep our commitment, which is that we'll reduce the deficit by 50%, the deficit we inherited, by 50% within the next 4 years. I thank you all very much for taking the time. I know there's a lot more questions. From my perspective, I'd like to do this more often. I'm happy to do it if we can work it out, but I apologize. I have to sign off right now. Thank you all very, very much.